Now, as I said last time, Voltaire was the great popularizer of the Enlightenment, and as you read him in the source book, you will see many of the ideas reflected which I talked about last time. For Voltaire, new ideas meant fighting against prejudice, meant an optimistic view of man's potential, which was shared, as you will read in your source book again, by Joseph II of Austria, who said that the greatest prejudice of all is not to dare to attack or to emancipate oneself from prejudice. That prejudice was, in their view, above all Christianity. Voltaire's Écraser l'Infâme, a general slogan. And instead, remember, they were deists. God is universal, the temple where the eternal dwells, and no one had a monopoly. Voltaire attacked the Gallican Church of France, Catholics, Protestants, and Jews with equal bitterness for thinking that they had a monopoly on God, and with equal fervor advocated toleration. But what I have just said in itself will set a limit on tolerance, for none of the traditional faith were tolerated. The test, as I told you in the Three Rings story in that fairy tale I told you last time, the test is a pragmatic one, if you like, to be beloved by God and man. What is bad are traditional religions, and they must be in some way expurgated. These are limits on tolerance, and they had some very important effects in the 19th century. One of them I want to illustrate right now, because it will become very important once the next century opens. For example, something that has puzzled many historians and distressed others is Voltaire's violent anti-Jewishness. The reason is, partly, because he blamed the Jews for Christianity, for founding Christianity. But this, well, it's true. After all, St. Paul did it, you know. He was the great advertising man, as my old teacher Arthur Darby Knox, the greatest authority on St. Paul, used to say. Never mind about that. But Voltaire stopped these attacks. Once, and this is typical again, a Jew had shed what he called his Jewishness. This part of the Enlightenment was to have fateful consequences in the next century, because it was really, in a way, contradictory. The condemnation of the Jew as Jew was left standing, and tolerance was divided from this condemnation of the Jew as Jew. The division between Judaism and the Jew turned out to be a very thin line indeed. And that plays into the way in which toleration was actually granted. Joseph II, the first to grant toleration to Jews, for example, and the Prussians afterwards, did not grant it unconditionally, but they granted it only to those Jews who had gone through the state schools. Only those Jews who had received a state education, and even at times only to those who had gone through military service. And the idea was always, as Joseph II put it, to make the Jews into honest people, honest workers, which they could only do if they had shed their Jewishness. This dual approach was to be fatal and will play directly into the racism of the next century. For once you add a racism to that, that division can no longer be maintained, and as it were, a Judaism will blanket all Jews. What you must remember here is that indeed, Jews did live separately in ghettos. The ghetto walls in Europe didn't fall until after the French Revolution. And in a place like Italy, not until the 1960s. and in Eastern Europe, not till 1918. So that you must remember again, which I have mentioned, I think, before, that when they dealt with this, the Enlightenment, they dealt with a separate culture, the only separate culture that existed in Europe. Namely, the ghetto culture was the only different culture that existed. And it is from that point of view that you must see much of their violent anti-Semitism, much of what is going to happen consequently, and indeed, in a sense, their view of Christianity, which was a view of Christianity as, if you like, a Jewish machination. Certainly that was Voltaire's view. And that view was, as I said, left standing in the 19th century. So that the matter of toleration was by no means so simple that you gave tolerance and that was it. The matter of toleration was directly related to the worldview, and its limits were directly related to that as well. Moreover, Voltaire was no democrat. He believed in superior intelligences. His famous phrase was that, after all, there are superior and inferior intelligences, for we must realize that Newton is different from a mule. And the superior intelligences are those who have freed themselves from prejudice, no more than the other intellectuals we have studied, like the humanists. Did these intellectuals believe in equality, in complete equality? Perhaps eventually, when everybody had become a Newton instead of a mule, but not right now, because most people were mules. Secondly, because of this, he believed that monarchy was right, but monarchy of a special type, which we now call enlightened despotism. Let us say the monarchy of Frederick the Great, at whose court he spent so many years. What is this monarchy of which he approved so much? First of all, it is a monarchy which rejected the divine right of king, utterly and completely. And that is just what I said. If you drink here, don't let your impediments roll around. Put them in a waste paper basket. Don't be slumped. Well, you are. Can't help. Now, rejected the divine right of king. Rejected the divine right of king. And secondly, to enforce the war against superstition and to listen to the philosophers. This is necessary. To enforce the war against superstition and to listen to the philosophers. This is necessary, for the common people are still and may always be full of superstition. As Voltaire said, as long as they are fools and rascals, there will be religion. Frederick discarded divine right, considered himself the first servant of the state. Frederick wrote books on the Enlightenment. He was the ideal kind of monarch, and he enforced a limited kind of toleration. He founded a scientific academy. For the enlightened despot must be an example to his people, an example of enlightenment. That is, above all, what is at the bottom of this new concept of monarchy. You can see it in practice, I think, with Joseph II of Austria, who furthered education, who furthered toleration in that what you might call peculiar way that I have told you about, who freed the serfs, didn't give them any land, of course, but he freed the serfs, and he lifted some of the censorship, some of the censorship. But never all of the censorship, of course. Now, through this idea of enlightenment, you can very easily see how these ideas came to permeate the upper class. The philosophers, I think, have been much misunderstood in a way. A great deal has been made of their deism, their belief of God as a watchmaker, their belief in internal natural laws, which you will read about. But in reality, here too, we must be careful to make distinctions. The philosophers believed in deism. They believed that the universe was governed by set natural laws. Natural laws man could discover through science. Natural laws which included the law of human goodness or of human potential. Quite right. But they were not dogmatic. They knew man's weaknesses and his strengths. They did not assert that reason is the sole criterion for man's action. They knew that it wasn't. But they emphasized that in order to get a society where reason is the criterion for man's action, you must question everything. Only through questioning, and it will remind you rightly of Descartes, only by questioning can you get a rationality which will master the world. Their ideal of natural law, of deism, left much elbow room for every man. As Lessing put it, men must prize each other through their differences. Therefore, you must get the degree right. Sure, there were these natural laws. Sure, there was God. But what is important is the kind of elbow room it gave to individuality. There is no such thing in the affairs of man as no ideology. There is no such thing in the affairs of man as absolute freedom. There are always limits. The question is, how wide are these limits? And if you look at the Enlightenment ideals, you will find that the limits are wider than the limits of traditional religion. That there is a definite worldview, but within it, the limits are wide. That is, after all, what everything depends upon. Moreover, a man like Voltaire brutally lampooned dogmatism. If you have read, put that next to a chromosome. I hope it isn't an abnormal one. That's not good for you. He brutally lampooned dogmatism in Candide. Brutally lampooned it. For the hero of Candide was somebody who believed in dogmatism. And it is brutally lampooned. How then did change come about? Change came about through the recognition of the limits of man and through the concentration of reality. They said, in effect, okay, there are rascals and fools and religion. But you can't do anything with that. You might as well forget about it. And try to enlighten, and try to work for enlightenment, and build from there. This idea made, in fact, an ever greater pragmatism in their thought. An ever greater pragmatism which comes with the second half of the 18th century. We must start with reason. We must cultivate our reason. The rest, you can't do anything with it. So you might as well ignore it. This is the sense of the famous closing line of Candide, a very famous line, we must cultivate our own garden. By this, Voltaire did not mean a withdrawal from the world, for he was very keen, you will see in a minute, that you should involve yourself, but rather in this idea that we must cultivate our own garden. Voltaire was saying, we must cultivate our faculty of reason, discover the natural law. The rest is for the birds. There is, therefore, less sort of fickless optimism than is usually made out, less abstract rationalism. But there is still a system. There is still a system, but a system that has elbow room in it. Even if you will say, if you will see next time, Rousseau was going to attack it and attack it very fundamentally. For in the last resort, action is all important to this man, Polemical action against the institution of Christianity and any other institutions that have to do with it. Polemical action. Now it is true that the philosophers sometimes used Christian words. They still were, after all, innovators who used a vocabulary from an older time. But they denied the substance of Christianity. They broke with it radically. And here they were helped by the ancient tradition. And they were always thinking in classical analogy. After all, it matters very much in what kind of analogy you think about. Let me give you an example. When Voltaire ridiculed baptism, Christian baptism, you know what they were. What a strange idea, he said, that a pot of water should wash away all crimes as though they were cleaning clothes. He was thinking directly of a passage from Ovid, which says, men who think that there are men who think that murder can be washed away by water. They thought very much in these analogies from the classics, and these analogies helped them with their radical break with Christianity. Yet the problem which arises is also clear. The ideas of the critical mind, of tolerance, of the limits of reason, these will be continued within the enlightened bourgeoisie. But yet, we must say they failed. They failed because what came after them was a reaction against all of this. They failed. Why? Why? First of all, they were, in your nice phrase, establishment intellectuals. So I would like to meet that intellectual who doesn't wish he was a Henry Kissinger right now. Never mind. Establishment intellectuals who thought they could change attitudes in working through the establishment, in transforming the divine right of kings into the enlightened despotism, who as intellectuals were concerned above all with changing the power structure, but also with ideas. They paid, and there is little controversy about this, they paid too little attention to economic and social reality. What they really wanted, if you come right down to it, is a change of attitude which broke with the past, but not a change in the economic and social order. A man like Montesquieu was in fact a conservative on this. Rousseau denied social and economic equality. He wanted to get rid of the extremes of poverty and the extremes of riches, Rousseau. But he didn't want equality in a social and economic sense. Not at all. He did not look for an egalitarian society. In the final resort, what they wanted as they became ever more pragmatic was to make the system they inherited more efficient rather than change it basically and structurally. And so they were totally dependent upon the despots, upon the king, the enlightened despots. And if they deserted them, they were indeed deserted. And as you will see, the successor for Frederick the Great deserted them, became a romantic. This happened all over, and they were sunk when that happened. Secondly, as intellectuals, like all intellectuals, you can hiss again on this. There's always hope, thank you. There's always hope. Like all intellectuals, they changed things. They brought a whole new attitude, and that is what is important. For at last, among the bourgeoisie, and that's what's going to be important in the next century. But they had lost touch with the masses. For in the 18th century, you have this religious revival. The revival which some of you in England know as Methodism, which we know in Europe as evangelism. and pietism, this great religious revival, with which they, of course, had no contact. If anything, they had a hatred. Let's put it this way. The terrified crowd, terrified of hell, who listened to Wesley, thirsted for myths and symbols. But the Enlightenment denied myths and symbols. It wanted just reason. It had no patience for myths and symbols. Myths and symbols were superstitions. And instead, the masses flocked to the Methodist and evangelical revival, which gave them emotional myths and emotional symbols, after all. Even Robespierre, as you will see in the Revolution, found that the people must have myths and symbols. Robespierre, who in the end, in the Tuileries Gardens, built a statue of the goddess of reason, which the people would worship as they had worshipped Christ and the Virgin Mary before. Robespierre, the practical politician, realized that for mass movements you need myths and symbols, and there has never been a successful modern mass movement without myths and symbols. This the intellectuals couldn't give to the masses. They emphasized reason. They emphasized learning. They changed a lot because they changed the direction of culture. And eventually that will have a great effect if only you think for a minute that Marx was an inheritor from the Enlightenment. It will have a great effect eventually. But at the moment, they are divorced from all of this. For this religious revival in the 18th century was, if you like, irrational, emotional. It gave people security. Myths and symbols give security to people. For that revival also rejected traditional theology, whether pietism in Germany or Methodism in England. It was also an emotional coming to Christ, because that's what you did in these mass movements, as you do in this evangelicalism to this day. You declare for Christ. You come to Christ. An emotional appeal. But there is the symbol. The symbol is Christ. It hasn't been taken away and some rationalism substituted. There is the symbol. It is a religion of the heart. Just think of John Wesley's mass meeting. This revival was, of course, one of the foundations of what we shall call Romanticism. And indeed, this revival, with which went pamphlets and books, all exhorting, all emotional, exhorting you to the Christian life, all emotional, at the same time that the philosophers were writing, injected into the 18th century atmosphere an emotionalism, not just through mass meeting, but through tracts, pamphlets, and books with which the Enlightenment couldn't rival. An emotional atmosphere which will be one of the foundations of Romanticism. Indeed, the evangelical movement of the 18th century will produce what we might call a united front. The united front of religion and Romanticism. That united front against the Enlightenment. And unlike any other united front, this will be victorious. The united front of religion and Romanticism. This will be the united front. And it was to prove stronger in the end than the critical mind of the Enlightenment. That must be clear. Though you could combine the two, and they were combined. They were combined above all in the Masonic orders. The Masonic orders which start in the 18th century. And the attraction of Masonry, the Masonic orders, was that they combined the two. On the one hand, the emotional satisfaction of secrecy, the great satisfaction that I'm sure many people have of belonging to a secret society, secret handshakes, rituals. People love this sort of thing, obviously, has a great appeal. But on the other hand, what is beyond this ritual is a rational core, for Masonry essentially accepted the deistic universe. It when Masons rejected Christianity, accepted the natural laws, accepted the deistic universe, but within a romantic framework. And that framework became more and more romantic as time went on. It took Egyptian mystery cults, partly went back to these Egyptian mystery cults to which some of, as I told you, the humanists went back to. So that Masonry combined the two. That was its great attraction, this kind of combination. You could have security. You could have security. You could have symbols. You could have myths. And you could also have reason. Therefore, of course, so many of the leading people of the 18th century were Masons, above all in the arts. People like Mozart, The Magic of Figaro, as you may know, is a Masonic opera. It's built around Masonic rites and Masonic rituals. But also later, the German poet Goethe was a Mason as well. And you can have both things, therefore, in this kind of Masonry. That also, I think, must be quite clear to you. What you have then in the 18th century is this dialectic between the Enlightenment, and I must emphasize it will continue in the bourgeoisie, especially in the upper bourgeoisie, it will continue and continue and continue. Besieged, and unfortunately in Europe by the 30s, only the Jewish bourgeoisie will still be a spokesman for the Enlightenment and nobody else. It was doomed. But what you have there, it will continue in the upper bourgeoisie. But otherwise, the Romantic movement, and when I come to Rousseau, I will of course say more about this, the Romantic movement connected with religion, with its myths and symbols, will in the end have the day. What then can we say about the Enlightenment as a whole, to wrap it up? First of all, you must remember that it was universalist in outlook and fact. To be sure, there were these distinctions between Newton and a mule, but they weren't national distinctions. Everybody could have enlightened. Everybody. It wasn't a national distinction. The distinction is between intellectuals and non-intellectuals, but it is not a national distinction. That must be clear. It took in most of Europe under French impetus. It is part of the continuing French domination, which you've had ever since Louis XIV, Catherine the Great of Russia, Frederick the Great of Germany. Frederick the Great spoke only French, not German. Catherine spoke mostly French, not German. It took the French culture. The Enlightenment is part of the domination of French culture. Why do I make such a thing about it? Because obviously Romanticism will also be a reaction against French culture. Obviously Romanticism and religion will come in as a reaction against this French predominance, because the Enlightenment was so much tied up with France and eventually with the French Revolution. This evangelism, this combination between Romanticism and religion, is the great force of the counter-revolution against the French Revolution eventually, but it will be, as you will see, successful. Secondly, its actual theory led to an attitude of mind which has practical results. From now on, there will be such a thing in Europe as men of goodwill, the bien-pensants, as we call them in France. As men of goodwill, it becomes part of the essence of liberalism. Indeed, it becomes in some countries like America the essence, but in Europe it becomes, I would say, only part, but a very essential thing in liberalism. No doubt about that. And from now on there will be such a thing, which you take for granted, as a man of goodwill in this sense. Thirdly, the practical results you must not underestimate. It emancipated minorities. Jews were for the first time accepted as citizens under the conditions that I have made clear only. But they were for the first time accepted as citizens. The ghetto walls fell in France and Germany, not in Italy, not in Eastern Europe, not where the church was strong in Italy, not in Eastern Europe in the different conditions. But it fell in part of the West. Serfdom disappears, except in Russia, in Europe. We must also put in the codification of law. Why do you say? Because what was codified by Catherine and Frederick was equality before the law. And that is a very real step towards equality. Equality between the law. The abolition of legal feudal privileges. That was already enshrined in the Enlightenment. There must not be any feudal privileges. That's part of the age of superstition. There must be equality before the law. And that was enshrined already in codifications in Russia and in Prussia and to a certain extent, but not very great, in France. Clearly also, the Enlightenment led support to the French and American Revolution. Despite these intellectuals, it led to a disintegration of absolutism. But it also led, despite these intellectuals, to a disintegration of mercantilism, because obviously the kind of freedom they wanted was extended by some into the economic realm. If natural law governs everything from morality to the life of the bee, then natural law must also govern economics. Then you must not interfere with economics any more than you would interfere with the life cycle of the bee. So that you have, therefore, the beginnings here too of what we call economic liberalism. The absolute monarchy and mercantilism will disintegrate together. And though, as I said, most of the Enlightenment was not interested in economics, yet their very theory was extended in the economic realm by others called the physiocrats. You will read about them, but laissez-faire liberal economics received here a very vital support, just as liberalism as a whole started in a sense, in a meaningful sense, with the Enlightenment. For what men could distill from this change of attitude, I think, was this. However much it fell short in reality, and I have criticized it, whatever it fell short, the kind of things that man could distill out of it, that also lasted, at least with the educated bourgeoisie. That the judgment of a man is by his standard of behavior and by the quality of his intellect rather than by his religious preference. That's a big change. That's a big change. That you judge a man by standard of behavior and quality of intellect, above all quality of intellect, rather than by his religious preference. That is a change you must not minimize. It is implied in Nathan the Wise, the story that I told you last time. Secondly, that in the end, the surest guarantee for progress, and they believed in progress because they were optimists, because they believed in the potentiality of man, they believed in progress. The surest sign or guarantee of progress is freedom. Freedom defined as freedom under natural law, which includes the critical mind. As I told you, all freedom is circumscribed. But here the definition of freedom includes the critical mind. Therefore, you can distill from it that freedom, including economic freedom, it's going to make a lot of difficulties later, freedom, including economic freedom, is the sure guarantor of progress. And lastly, universalism. No man, once he is enlightened, we must always say this, once he is enlightened, must lord it over another. There is no divine appointment to authority. The only appointment to authority lies here, intellectual appointment to authority. But there is no divine appointment to authority. Fourthly, the pragmatism involved, that it's man's behavior who counts, and this means that the intellectual must experiment in society. He must try to reform society. Action is all important. He must try to reform society. And there is this pragmatism, which I hope you understand. The pragmatism which says, we've got to operate with reason. The rest is beside the point. So that they were prone to proceed, as if all men were indeed rational. They were prone to proceed to their experimentation, to make, if you like, the more efficient. Any kind of pragmatism, which excluded, by definition, by their definition, fundamental social and economic breaks, because in the last resort, everything was under natural law. The more freedom you had, the closer you were to natural law, the more brains you had, the closer you were to natural law. Everything was, after all, under natural law, so revolution was out. Revolution was out. Now, with all of this, of course, we have Rousseau's first sentence of the social contract. Men are born free, yet everywhere they are in chains. That all of this seems so familiar to you is, of course, due that the American founding fathers were, to a man, deists and philosophers. And so that all this came to America in much greater strength and retained greater strength here than in Europe. There is no comparison possible of the strength here. Now, we have left Rousseau, and I'm happy that I can devote a lecture to Rousseau for two reasons, I think. First of all, he is again central because he goes beyond the Enlightenment and touches on awfully important problems. And secondly, because his influence is huge and vast. You may be reading now with difficulty. In the first part of the 19th century, everybody read who was literate at all. It was a runaway bestseller, especially, of course, for the women who could get emotional satisfaction. It was a runaway bestseller. So, there is something to it, you know. The evangelical movement was also largely carried by the female sex. I have nothing against it. I'm just stating it as a fact. So that, and it is a fact. So what you have, disprove it. What you have therefore here, then. And secondly, because Rousseau, of course, is always topical. Well, what does Daniel Cohen-Bendit in France say when somebody asks him about his ideology? Rousseau, what do the students in Berlin quote? Rousseau. In other words, Rousseau has a topicality which is not vouchsafed to any of the others, because no revolutionary student, to my knowledge, has quoted Voltaire. But all for good reason. But I hope I made clear. But they do quote Rousseau. Together with Rosa Luxemburg, he has become, and Proudhon, I guess, he has become one of the new trinity of culture heroes. So that it is, I think, very important to have a special lecture on Rousseau, and I'm glad that you can have one. And this I will do next time, but now I am stopping again for any questions that you might have. Yes. Mm-hmm.